This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Masked Marauders, Double Lives and Secret Identities in Speculative Fiction.
Now, this week's suggestion came from Jules, and she hasn't actually filled me in on what inspired this episode. So, Jules, what did inspire this episode?
I'm going to have to confess to my shameful habit of internet stalking, or at least Twitter stalking, authors I really like. And it was something Victoria Schwab said, that her favourite trope was basically double lives, characters having to live double lives in fiction. And I'm like, actually, that's a really good one, and we haven't discussed that yet, so I've kind of stolen it from there.
It is actually a really good trope. I am rather fond of it.
Yeah, and I suppose what I like about it is, or rather, I like about it, and it's also really frustrating, is the fact that a proper double life in speculative fiction usually means that the protagonist is really, really screwing up what is perceived as their real life, their normal life, because of all the lies they have to tell.
Yeah. And I like it. You know, I just said that I really like it, and I do like it, but also sometimes I do get really, really frustrated with it. And I think probably, there's so many examples of the double life.
There is. I've got, I'll tell you what, a good one to start with, because there's been so many incarnations. I'm going to suggest Superman.
Yes.
So, obviously, from the DC universe, everyone must know who Superman is. Seriously. Yeah. I mean, if you live in the middle of nowhere in the wilds of Africa in a little hut with loads of goats, I bet you know who Superman is. It's that ubiquitous. When you say superhero, people are like, oh, yeah, Superman, obviously.
Superman, yeah. Or they think Batman.
or Batman. But let's go with Superman to start with, because it's hilarious the way that the double life is managed.
Yeah.
And it's a bit less angsty most of the time. Obviously, Superman, who is this Adonis with black hair and blue eyes, about 6'5", puts on a pair of spectacles and a rather nerdy suit, and nobody realises he's Superman. No one thinks for a minute, oh well, you know, that strangely good-looking guy is in fact the guy who's flying around in a blue jumpsuit with his underpants on over the top. Okay, it does kind of feed into the idea that people are only taken at face value. In the same way that when Shakespeare had one of his female characters dressing up as a boy, people see what they expect to see, and they don't expect someone that extraordinary to be in their midst at the Daily Planet. Therefore, Clark Kent is just rather different, socially awkward, socially inept, maladroit reporter.
He's
got a bit of a thing for Lois Lane. And I suppose my favourite incarnation is when, unlike the more recent films, Lois Lane has no idea who Superman really is. She's got a real thing for Superman because, you know, she's a red-blooded woman. And meanwhile, poor Clark Kent's kind of like, oh, can I carry your books for you, Miss Lane, kind of thing. And she's just like, oh, shut up, Clark. Go away, no one wants to talk to you. You might be a big thing back in small town, but you're... Smallville, not small town, sorry.
Smallville.
So, yeah, and I suppose what I really like there is the juxtaposition, because Superman is... You've seen the original... I say the original films. The films with... Oh, God, the name's gone. The 80s films.
Yeah, yeah, where his underpants are firmly on the outside.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And it's just a case of... He comes across as very slightly too confident, a bit too good to be true, a bit smarmy, almost.
Yeah.
And the contrast between that and Clark Kent, where he's trying to talk to Lois, and he's dropping things, and he's falling over things, and he's just looking like a big nerd, and she's just looking right through him.
Yeah.
I really enjoy that juxtaposition.
Yeah. And it is actually quite good, because there is a psychology behind it. And someone made, because I was reading about this actually, on a blog post, and someone made a really excellent point, which is that there is this psychological element where it's not just the way that he acts, it's the very way that he holds himself. And in the Justice League cartoon, they do it particularly well, where you see that when he is Clark Kent, he hunches.
Yeah.
He hunches over so that he's small. He seems smaller. He seems a bit more rounded as well with his shoulders.
Yeah.
So it changes his shape. His hair is different. He has the glasses. He speaks in a slightly different way. And the other thing is that, you know, people point out that actually celebrities and co will sometimes go out and do different things. And just hold themselves in a slightly different way, and people just see right through them. And I think an excellent example of that is Terry Pratchett. Now, Terry Pratchett, whenever he was doing authory kind of business, always wore a particular hat.
Yes.
And he reported, of course, in the moment he's wearing the hat, everybody recognized him. You know, everyone knew Terry Pratchett. You know, they knew them in the area, and so anytime he was, you know, anywhere bookish, lots of people would be recognizing him. If he took the hat off, nobody recognized him at all.
So what he trained them to do was to recognize the hat.
They recognized the hat. So they recognized, they had one particular image of him, and it was always in that hat. So without the context of the hat, things really changed. And so, you know, we say, oh my God, everyone in it's not central. Where is he? Star City? I can't remember which city he's in, but basically, they all expect him to be wearing the suit. They all expect him, you know, to have these particularly vibrant colours, to have this presence. And the other thing is that actually, not many of them really get to see him up close.
No, you're really thinking Metropolis.
Metropolis, thank you. It's Metropolis. Sorry, it's because it's central. for Flash, it's Gotham, for Bats, and yeah, and then I was thinking Star Labs. I got confused. There's a lot of locations, and Starling City is Arrow. Anyway, I'm just being a nerd now.
Sidebar, but these are all thinly veiled metaphors for New York, and I really really loved in the most recent DC films. One of the things I actually did love was the fact that Gotham City and Metropolis are like next door neighbours, right across the river. They're the same place.
But sorry, a complete tangent, but I think there is a comic where basically Superman and Batman actually swap cities for a day.
Yes.
And they both hate it because like Bat's like, oh my God, it's everything's so bright here, I've got no like shadows to hide in, and
everyone's
Superman's
so
there
cheerful.
Like, this is a den of iniquity, what the hell. So anyway, regardless, so you have this expectation of Superman, and you don't really have an expectation of Clark Kent. And the other thing is that someone else made an excellent point, which is that we will often laugh at doppelgangers, because actually people do look, you'll have at least six people in the world who look a lot like you.
Yeah, there was that study that was done, because I referenced it. I did the research on this for Eye of the Tide, and basically there is the Twin Strangers project, and you can look it up online.
Yeah.
It's quite interesting. Basically, they estimate that you will find eight people across the world who look very, very like you, as in could be mistaken for you. And the reason for this is that as humans, we are predisposed to see faces as a composite of parts rather than to look at separate features and compare them. So as long as, I mean, they won't actually tell you what the eight points of reference on the face are that you sort of look at and see as a composite. Because they don't want to taint the results that they're trying to get. But they've posted pictures, and it's fascinating. People who've never met, who have no genetic, they're not related in any way at all. And some of them look absolutely identical. Some of them are just sort of similar enough that you do a second glance.
Yeah.
And it's really bizarre. And I suppose it does, the whole secret identities thing would sort of like feed into that a little bit, as in it's a case of it's too ridiculous for the person to be who you might think they are. And so
exactly.
You put it out of your mind.
But yeah, isn't like no one who walks into the Daily Planet, someone could walk into the Daily Planet and go, oh my God, that's Superman. And then immediately go, what am I thinking? Superman lives in a crystal fortress Why would Superman be in the middle of the city holding down, you know, a 9-to-5 job? Like, it's really ludicrous, actually, if you think about it. You just think, why would he be here? Because everyone knows where Superman goes. Haha, that rhymed. Because everyone knows where Superman goes when he's not fighting crime. He's out in his little crystal fortress up in the North Pole or wherever it is. I don't know. And people know that that's a kind of a residence of his. So they have no reason to suspect that he's there living among them.
Yeah. And it is part of that whole sort of people are taken at face value, because that's how we have to start, really. You have to start by taking people at face value. Because you cannot possibly form intense relationships where you really know the person and you'd know them anywhere with, like, everybody you're going to encounter in your life.
Exactly. Though that being said, there was the Green Lantern movie.
Yeah.
Was terrible.
It's quite a while ago. I think I went in with such low expectations. I thought, yeah, this is all right.
Listen, I actually enjoyed watching it, but like it definitely wasn't a good movie, if that makes sense. But I actually did enjoy it. But there is this really, really excellent point where Hal in the Green Lantern costume goes to see the girl he really, really likes. And she just looks at him and goes, Hal? And he's there like, no. And she's like, what, seriously, you thought you could cover up your cheekbones and I wouldn't know who you were? I've known you since we were like 6. And I just really liked that she took one look at him and immediately recognised who he was.
I love that. And that's true, because if you know somebody that well, that's where it stretches credulity, is the fact that if it's someone who's known you and grown up with you all that time, to then suddenly don a mask and they'll be like, oh, who are you? And where has my friend gone?
My friend who was here only moments ago.
I've never seen the two of you together. It's like the old He-Man cartoons. And Tila was all sort of like, ah, He-Man. And then Adam would turn up. It's like, oh, go away, Prince Adam. Okay, you might be suspiciously muscular, but you don't have his tan. It's the same sort of thing. And it's like, they're supposed to have grown up together. It's like, right, so he puts more clothes on, and for some reason you can't recognise him. What exactly are you looking at on He-Man, Tila?
Yeah, basically, exactly that. So there's I can understand it on one level, and on another level I think you kind of need to take it with a bit of a pinch of salt. Now the one I really like, and the one I want to talk about, is probably Spider-Man.
Okay.
Because he's got one of the best versions of the double life, really. And I think the reason why his double life is usually the most interesting is that, unlike with Batman and Superman, he's actually a teenager.
Yeah.
So with Batman, like, Bruce Wayne has also got friends, if that makes sense. Like, he has Alfred on his side. And there have been times when Alfred has donned the Batman suit, or even that, you know, Dick Grayson has donned it, or, you know, someone else has done it. And so you've seen Bruce Wayne and Batman close to one another.
Yeah.
And also, you know, Bruce Wayne has got this whole identity of, you know, being this playboy and just having lots of money. And so no one ever really questions kind of what he's up to. I don't really know of many versions where there's been a real kind of proper worry about what being Batman is doing to his social life. I can't really recall anything like that, nor do I ever recall. I'm sure there is some, but I just don't really recall them for Superman either. Spider-Man, however, because he's a student, not only is he a student, he's completely on his own. He has no one within... very few people, at least, who know who he is.
Yeah.
He doesn't have any psychics or anything like that, or anyone, you know, who can help him out. And often he's put into positions where he has to sacrifice his social life in order to be Spider-Man, and there's very little reward. And a very common thing that you see in the Spider-Man comics and in some of the old series is that this ends up with him dissolving friendships. Like, his friends just say, oh, you're never around. They don't find him reliable. He messes up continuously. He misses things out. And it even results in, you know, him not being there on important occasions.
Yeah, it really messes up his life, doesn't it?
It really does mess up his life. And he often has these crises where he suddenly goes, who do I need to be? Who is it more important that I am? Should I just be Spider-Man or should I be Peter Parker? Because he actually can't balance the two of them. And I really, really like that, because you have this definite sense that these are actually two very different identities. It is literally one person trying to live two lives at once.
Yeah.
And they really do highlight that well, the absolute impossibility of that situation where you literally do have to try and be in two places at once, and you have to be two different people at once. And you have to keep remembering who you are at different occasions. So the moment Spider-Man puts on the mask, he can't be Harry Osborn's friend. You know, he can't be, he can't go and help Aunt May. He can't do these kind of, these sorts of things. I really, really like the way that they do that. And it's also actually kind of why I also find it really frustrating, because I just kind of want to grab him and say, bring someone into your confidence, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, I get it. I suppose, I mean, that sort of, it's worth us looking now at why people would assume a secret identity. And usually in the case of superheroes, it's not so much to protect them, although that is there, but it's to protect the people connected with them, their weak spots that people can get at. It's something Orson Scott Card said in Ender's Game that sort of stuck with me, and I'm not really endorsing Orson Scott Card, but this is actually a good point. He said, personal affection is a luxury you can afford only once all your enemies are dead.
Yeah.
And it is the case of, with a superhero, if they've got some sort of ability and you haven't and you're against them, the obvious thing to do is get at them via their friendships and their families and the people they care about.
Yeah.
So having a mask, wearing a mask to do the things that they're doing is the thing that protects the people who are connected with them, which is another great trope, because that all comes falling down in a horrendous fashion when one of the villains works out who somebody is and snatches Aunt May or whoever.
Yeah. Yeah, and causes all sorts of trouble. And they actually kind of did that in Homecoming, Spider-Man Homecoming, the new Spider-Man who's part of the MCU now, where you have that great moment where Peter goes up to pick up his date, and the door opens, and it's the villain, and they both look at each other like,
"That was perfect."
Well, shit.
I mean, to be honest, I'm kind of a bit in two minds with the new Spider-Man films, because I'm like, I quite liked I got fed up of them remaking the origin story again and again and again, because it was clearly a dog in the manger, we're going to keep the rights and not let Marvel have them back thing.
Yeah.
But also, they were making him younger and younger and younger each time, and Aunt May suddenly got younger and younger, which irritated me very slightly. But it does actually work, and that was an absolutely beautiful piece of cinema there.
Yeah.
It's like, oh yeah, I've heard a lot about, oh god, your dad is my arch nemesis.
No, I actually really liked, you know, people said, oh yeah, they just keep making Aunt May younger and younger. But actually, it does make sense. And I like the fact that this is now a young Peter Parker, because he was supposed to be young. When he starts, he's actually not old at all. And that's, you know, a big part of his identity is the fact that he struggles so much because he's so young. And he's Spider-Man. You know, he's not the Wonder Boy. He's not a sidekick, but he's the age of a sidekick at this point in his life. And he's struggling on his own, and he's getting all of the attention and all of the danger and all of the bad media that a grown man should have. And he's trying to hold up an identity as a grown man, despite the fact that he's a teenager who's worrying about school, who's worrying about his studies, who's worrying about money, things like that. You know? Yeah. So I really like that. And I like the fact that Aunt May was young, because actually, I don't really know why she would be that old. She's meant to be the sister.
You can, I suppose, when obviously when it was written, it was a bit more sort of, oh, well, you know, a frumpy childless couple who were much, much older than his actual parents. So perhaps his mum or dad, whoever, or the baby of the family.
Yeah.
And they had a 15-year age gap between children, which obviously does happen.
Yeah.
It and does. It's just, I think it was supposed to be something like that, but it was playing into that stereotype.
Yeah.
And I can see it, and it does kind of make sense. On the other hand, I get a bit irritated when they start shuffling older characters out of films.
Yeah, I agree. That did annoy me because I just thought, why?
Particularly older women, because apparently you can have an older mentor who's male.
Yeah, but not an older woman, because old women don't exist. Everyone knows this.
Yes, you become invisible once you hit a certain age. And it just, that sort of bugs me. Although I did go and see Ant-Man and Wasp.
Well, I haven't seen it yet, and I want to. How is it?
It's good. I enjoyed it. I think I quite like it because it's a lighter aspect of the Marvel Universe, which has got very doom and gloom lately.
Yeah, on account of certain events.
I mean, no spoilers, but Evangeline Lilly, who plays the Wasp, is very good. And they don't make a point of trying to make her character younger than she is. It's really interesting. Michelle Pfeiffer plays her, the character's Hope's mother, basically. Mm-hmm. And there is a scene when Michelle Pfeiffer actually says, I've been gone for 30 years, or I've been gone for 3 decades. And you're like, okay, hang on a minute. Hope was about 7 or 8 when you disappeared, and you've been gone for 30 years. That means Hope's not very far off 40. And they haven't tried to make the character any younger. And they've got an actress of the same age to play that character.
Yeah.
So I tried to point it out to Alan, and he was kind of like, oh, I didn't really notice. And I'm like, well, you probably wouldn't, because you're not noticing people your age getting shuffled out of films constantly.
Yeah.
So I was chuffed with that. And Marvel is making some good choices lately, what with that and with Black Panther and various other things.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I think that that's really cool.
Obviously, it helps if you look like Evangeline Lilly, but
yeah, this is true. She's pretty damn good looking. But you know, regardless, you know, it's that, you know, it tends to be that male superheroes are allowed to age gracefully, whereas female superheroes,
once you hit 26, you're kind of over the hill.
Yeah,
and they'll just keep putting you with younger and younger characters.
Yeah,
which is kind of gross.
Super gross. Anyway,
back to Secret Identities. I'm going to bring up Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Obviously. Yes. Now, she's within the same sort of category as Peter Parker, in that she faces a very similar kind of thing. And these great expectations from everyone around her to
she
be...
She starts off in exactly the same situation, as in she just wants to be a normal girl.
Yeah.
Certainly to start with. And the thing is, her keeping her secret identity, which, by the way, means that anyone who's seen her, who is on the opposite side, needs to die, because they can't be allowed to go and spread it.
Yeah.
Because there are some seriously bad enemies who would come and kill her. It's for her protection, to start with. Because it's easier to kill a Slayer who is young and inexperienced, and a lot of them die that way in canon. And obviously to protect her friends and her family as well. But she doesn't go around wearing a mask or anything like that. It's kind of like, no, this is me, and, you know, only one of us is going to walk away from this fight. And it is very do or die from the beginning, until she gets more experienced and the vampires know exactly who they are, and they've got no intention of coming and fighting her, because they want to live. But yeah, it causes some real problems for her, and it causes barriers between her and the few friends who do actually know who she is. It causes barriers for her at school.
Mm-hmm.
And it absolutely wrecks her love life, which is quite an important thing for a 16-year-old girl as well.
Yeah.
And it's played up. It's played up in a few episodes. There's one in the very first season, and the first season is a bit clunky nowadays. but the actual writing's pretty good. And the episode's called Never Kill a Boy on the First Date. And she's got this thing for this guy called Owen, and he's quite a sort of introspective guy who likes poetry and is quite sensitive, and he's quite cute. And she goes out with him on a date, or she thinks she's having a normal date.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Giles keeps saying, well, there's apocalypse about to happen. And she's like, for God's sake, can it happen on another night?
Yeah.
they get it wrong. And, well, rather, Willow and Xander turn up and say, yeah, you know, your other friends, the really pale ones who don't like sunlight and don't go out in the day, yeah, they're doing something tonight. So they all end up going to going to the morgue. And he tags along. The thing that's really sad is the fact that she thinks that's it. It's all over. That there's some. He gets injured, and he doesn't realise there are vampires at the end of it. And she's sort of like, "Oh well, that's it. You know, that's that dating option going downhill." But he actually says, "No, it was great. I've never felt so alive." And she realises that actually now he's into her for the excitement.
Yeah.
And that makes him a liability because he's not going to be careful. So she ends up breaking it off. And it's a really good look at being responsible for the relationships you form when you have these other responsibilities.
Yeah. And that is the other thing, is that this is, especially with the younger characters who have masked identities, relationships often do play a large part in their story arcs. A, because it's it's YA and romance is a particular trope, but B, because it does bring up this scenario of, if I go into this relationship, what's the result going to be, and who do I go into this relationship as? Can I tell them who I really am? And if they do know who I really am, will that put them in danger? And it brings up these all these questions of trust as well. And the problem is that there's never really a right answer, because you can never really guess what's going to happen.
Yeah, because on one hand, you've got the idea that with real power comes loneliness, because no one really understands you. So do we expect them to be human and want to form human connections like most people do, but keep things secret, in which case that relationship is never going to fly completely, because if you start it with a lie, it's unstable? Or do we expect them to be alone all the time? And the trouble with that is, people who don't form human connections of some kind, whether it's friendships or, you know, lovers, families, or whatever, tend to go so insular, they lose contact with why they're doing what they're doing. And it's the age-old dilemma, really, I suppose.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, yeah, I mean, there's lots of great moral questions, as well as a lot of humour involved with secret identities and double lives. Okay, I'm going to suggest the one I'm going to talk about. People who deliberately set up double lives. It's not a case of they're handed power or handed a destiny, but they set up double lives because their real life is the secret life. And their external life is the mask that they wear for everyone else to make themselves acceptable. And an excellent example of that is Dexter.
Yes.
Dexter, for those of you who don't know, was a character created from a series of books that starts with Darkly Dreaming Dexter. And they are really silly in a lot of ways, because the idea is that he is rescued as a child from a situation that is utterly horrific. And it changes him, and as he grows up, his new foster father recognises a potential in him for a desire to kill people. Kill and dismember in, you know, true serial killer fashion. And his father, instead of saying, oh God, you need help, I can't deal with this, trains him on police procedure, on how not to get caught, in order that he can set up a good double life, but sets up the code, Harry's code it's called. Mm-hmm. So that he can prey on other predators, specifically it. And there's a special place in his heart for people who prey on children, for example. And things get very, very tangled, because basically Dexter has no moral compass of his own, at least not to start with. And later on it's explored that actually Harry kind of fucked him up a bit more by giving him that code and trying to push him in that direction than he would if he'd perhaps tried early on to get him some kind of help, psychological help.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of very dark humour, and, you know, don't look at it for your police procedure because it's absolute bollocks. But the rest of it is very, very good. It's very compulsive watching. It is kind of popcorn for the brain. But you can't help rooting for this serial killer who does really awful stuff to people and, you know, keeps trophies. He's killing them not because he thinks it's really justice. He's killing them because he likes to kill people. There's no real excuse for it. But obviously that's not acceptable. So he puts on this absolutely perfect mask the rest of the time, whereby he is this blood spatter analyst who works with a police department. His sister's a cop. His father was a cop. Everyone's like, oh, good old Dexter, the guy who brings the donuts. He's always got a smile.
Yeah.
And I really love the way that they flipped the idea of the double life, the secret identity in that. And that's really kind of what I took away from the show. I mean, the books get quite weird. And I stopped at the third one because I was kind of like, I'm kind of bored now. But I did watch, even as mad and stupid as the series of Dexter got, and it completely jumped the shark. And I'm not even going to talk about the misappropriation of terms like psychopath, which they clearly didn't understand when they were writing it. I still found it like, it was like, it was cracktastic. You know, you kind of had to watch it to find out what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm trying to think of an example, actually, of the secret identity where it's in reverse, because usually what it is that you have the very friendly, the unmasked identity is a very friendly, kind of very mild person who no one would really look twice at, and then as the hero, they're these confident, dangerous, powerful beings. And I really want to find an example where, unmasked, the person's just a complete asshole. Nobody likes them. And when they've got their mask on, they're just the kindest, gentlest, sweetest person ever. That everyone's like, oh, that person is a real hero. And if that hasn't been done yet, I want to write it. Yeah, whereas they're like, haha, they'd never suspect me. I'm a dick.
I keep them away from me just by being an ass. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean, and that would be really cool. I think they sort of touched on it a bit with Christian Bale's performance of Batman, because when he's being Bruce Wayne, he's being callow and feckless and pleasure loving and not appearing to care about anybody, even though you know that's not the case at all.
Yeah,
but they haven't really done the job that you're talking.
Yeah, and I really, really do want that. I think possibly, and I've said this before, one of my absolute favourite superheroes within the DC universe is Flash.
Yeah.
Because as a hero, he's just very sweet, especially in the old Justice League series. He's incredibly sweet. He's very, very kind, and he's quite goofy.
Yeah.
And then in his daily life, he actually works as a police officer because he works in the criminal lab. So he does does detective work with them. Oh, God, I've just forgotten what the word is. What's the word, Jules?
Forensics.
Forensics. Thank you. Yeah, he's a forensic scientist, which I think is brilliant. and of course no one would think the forensic scientist was the Flash. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I really, really do like that, because as a forensic scientist, he's obviously a bubbly kind of guy, but he's also very nerdy. He's completely different. And yet there's just this, the thing I really, really like about the Flash is, as I said, his persona when he has the mask on, is also kind of a very friendly persona, in that it's almost hard to kidnap anyone the Flash cares about, on account of the fact that every time they see the Flash, he's like painting somebody's fence. He knows everybody by name in Central as well. He literally just goes past these. They're like, hi Mary, how's the leg, and I'll be around yours later for some fishing. And he just spends like the majority of his time as the Flash, and then just as part of his day job, he's there just still fighting crime, which I think is amazing. He's literally always on the clock.
I suppose the advantage is the fact that he's fast, because otherwise, how the hell would you fit those two things in?
Yeah, exactly. And I think literally that is the reason the only reason he can be a superhero is that he's the only person who actually has time and an infinite amount of energy, apparently. But I was going to say, but the whole masked identity thing, it really starts with the Scarlet Pimpernel, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Which is a book I haven't read for about 20 years, so I'm going to be a bit rusty.
Hey, you're ahead of me. I've never even read it at all, so...
But, yeah, I can't remember all the character names, so apologies, but basically set during the French Revolution, whereby, you know, we don't think it's right that aristocrats? That would be an interesting genre crossover.
I think it's been done before, actually.
Anyway, the Scarlet Pimpernel is basically the originator of the superhero and
written
went
by
over
woman.
And liberated these poor aristocrats from the French Revolution, so they didn't meet Madame Guillotine, in a nutshell.
But did anyone know who his real identity was?
I think so, but... As I said, it wasn't one that really stuck with me, and it's been 20 years since I read it, so I'm going to have to go away and check it out.
Yeah. But I really do think that that whole kind of the double life, it was probably inspired by actually a number of other things as well. And tropes within other genres, which were kind of combined to create something which is now, it's not exclusively superhero, but the double life trope is a very prominent one that you tend to find within superhero fiction, to the point that even if there's a double life in anything else, if someone's leading a double life, people will go... will either make a spy joke or a superhero joke, really.
Yeah, definitely. So, going back to... I've just lost my train of thought. Sorry, I'm going to start that sentence again. Yeah, no, it's a really good point. Double lives turn up in speculative fiction in places where you wouldn't necessarily think of them immediately. I know we talk about Dracula a lot, but I am going to mention vampires. Because... if you look at the original vampire novel, part of the big reveal is that he's kind of living a double life.
Or yeah.
Not, he's unliving a double life, you know, because he's undead.
You should be ashamed of yourself.
I mean, it's definitely an aspect that's played up in, for example, Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula, Bram Stoker's Dracula, rather. And you have Prince Vlad projecting himself as this much younger character in order to court Mina.
Yeah.
Well, he's Dracula all the time, but that aspect of him is him. It's him from a time before he was this blood-soaked monster. So it's the tiny part of him that's still human, perhaps coming forward. But it is very much used as a mask in order to get close to her, because he knows he's monstrous.
Yeah.
And that she would never grow to love him if she saw him straight off as the wrinkled 500-year-old being that babies, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, so what do you can imagine it on a Tinder app, can't you? So what do you do for fun? And he puts up the really old profile picture. It's like, oh, by the way, I like to drink baby's blood, kind of thing. I
think I'll be swiping left.
But, I mean, that's something that almost all other fiction writers who write about vampires have actually taken on board, whether they realise they've done it or not. Again, we don't want to talk about Twilight too much, but the vampires originally present themselves as being human.
Yeah.
When they're most definitely not. And if you look at L.J. Smith's Nightworld series, the supernatural creatures in that very definitely present themselves as being human. And it is deliberately a double life, in order partly so that they can hunt, but also partly so that they don't get killed by the humans who might wake up to what they are. As a side note, I'm just going to talk about double lives and and relationships. And as an example, I'm going to mention an 80s kids cartoon called Gem and the Holograms that Madeline probably doesn't know anything about.
I do not.
This was something my sister and I used to watch when we were wee little girls. It's ridiculous. It's about a girl called Jerrica, whose father owned a music company, Starlight Music. I can't believe how much of this I remember. And he, a mansion called Starlight House. And she takes in loads of waifs and strays and orphans and looks after them. But the house is absolutely falling apart. Her father dies, leaving her in financial difficulties. And she has a boyfriend called Rio. You couldn't make this shit up. I mean, obviously someone did, but you just couldn't. And she wants to get money from the music company, which she owns a good proportion of. But her father's business partner has been embezzling money. This is like sounds really in-depth for a children's cartoon, but you know, this was all there. Someone really put the effort into writing a story rather than turning it into a weekly 25-minute advert for children's toys, which is what a lot of 80s cartoons are. Anyway, so what she does is she finds her father's secret lab, because obviously he would have one.
Oh, naturally.
And her father seems to have created an AI machine called Synergy, which can alter people's appearances with the use of holograms. And she takes on the the identity of the lead singer of a band calls herself Gem. She does actually look quite different because she has serious 80s makeup and 80s hair going on, and her hair is pink rather than blonde.
Okay, yep.
And for some reason, nobody questions that it's Jerrica's friends and Jerrica's sister who are in the band with her. This is just like, no, Jerrica's just the road manager kind of thing.
But why can't she just be herself? I don't understand.
That's the plot hole they never cover. Anyway, it turned into a big thing where they've got to protect Synergy from anyone getting hold of her, because this is dangerous technology that her father has just turned into basically this synthesizer who projects interesting clothing onto female singers. God knows what he was doing in his spare time.
I have a pretty good idea.
Well, yeah, quite possibly. That's an interesting fan fiction waiting to be written right there. Anyway, it's kind of all good fun, and Jerrica uses it as a way to take back her father's music company from his business partner.
Yeah.
And they set up a battle of the bands. He brings forth his own, like, all-girl band as well. So it's basically the battle of the girl bands.
Of course.
And they use some quite unethical methods. But the thing I want to talk about is Rio. Rio is, like, quite serious with Jerrica. I mean, obviously, you don't know that they're sleeping together, and she has a house full of children, so probably not.
Yeah.
A house full of teenagers, even. And then Rio starts up an affair with Jem. And she never tells him that she's the same person. So he thinks he's having an affair, and that he's in love with two different women, and he can't choose between them. And all the while she's kind of like, yeah, it's just me, and I'm kind of enjoying being two different people with him.
Wow.
And it's just, I was just kind of like, why at no point did, and it just turned into this massive thing. It's like, oh, but I can't tell Rio who I really am. And like, well, do you not think he might like to know? Because he thinks he's cheating on you, but he's cheating on you with you.
But I like the fact that he thinks he's cheating on you. But to be honest, I'd be really worried if I was dating someone who was cheating on me with me, but didn't seem to find that that was an issue.
What if it's still pink, like, hair, you with your awesome 80s pink hair?
No, but I'm still like, hold on a second. You are still, you think you're cheating on me. So why? Like, seriously.
There's even a point where Jem's kissing him, and he gently pushes away and goes, no, I can't hurt Jerrica like this. And she's like, oh, okay. And like, are you not going to tell him? Seriously. That would have been
Why are you keeping this a secret? Like, there's literally no reason for her to keep it a secret.
I know, it's mad. It's kind of, it is the most contrived bit of conflict ever. But, I mean, the cartoons. Really silly, but kind of good. I haven't seen it for years, so it might actually not be good, and it's just my memory.
You saw what you wanted to see.
Yeah.
I want to give a good example of actually the young woman trope where she's actually a superhero. And this is someone, this is a cartoon where they've done that, where, and it's Kim Possible.
Oh, Kim Possible's awesome.
Yeah, Kim Possible, who does not have a secret identity.
No.
She's just Kim Possible. And, like, she's got her life sorted. People are like, oh, she's like, I can't come to tryouts. I've got to save the world. And everyone's like, yeah, that's fair. Like, it makes sense. She never has any awkward, you know, moments with her parents. Her parents are like, okay, you just do you.
No, she really is just out, isn't she?
Yeah,
she's out, she is. Superhero.
She's just out having a good time. And like, she never tries to disguise it. And, you know, on the one side, you're like, well, that's not very practical. But on the other side, you're like, hell, it's really practical, especially as a teenage girl trying to do school at the same time. Like, she's not getting detentions and stuff like that because she's just there like, well, I could have let the school explode or I could have been in, you know. So, yeah. So that's actually probably the one I can name where they've just completely bypassed the double identity thing.
Yeah. So why do you think we have why does the double the double life, the secret identity thing resonate so much with us? Because my theory is that at some point in our life, I don't know, did you ever play dress up as a child?
Oh, as a child.
Okay. But, oh yeah, you know, people cosplay now, don't they? And it's great and it's good fun. And it's just a case of we all like to play with the possibility of being someone other than ourselves. And with the idea that under the ordinary exterior, that there is, you know, there's heroes and villains and secret agents.
Yeah.
And I think that's that's my theory as to why it's such a huge.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think that there is a large part of that. And I would say that it would even go a little bit further than that, because actually, really, I can't remember where it is, but it's a saying that we have three faces. The face we show the people around us, the face that we show our family, and the face that we show ourselves.
Yeah.
And actually, we will always be a little bit, we'll be slightly different people, depending who we're with. You know, when I'm with my friends, they will surely tell you that I cuss like a sailor. and that, you know, I talk about boobies and other inappropriate things. Because, hey, why not? boobies and books, those are my interests. Boobies, books and fairies and swearing, that's what I talk about with my friends. Oddly enough, that's not the kind of person I am with my grandparents. Why? But I'm just not. And, you know, we have to remember that human beings are incredibly complicated, and there's no one level to us. So actually, we will throw up different faces depending who we're with. And that kind of is, you know, part of different identities, and especially people who live in the social spectrum, you know, on social media, I should say, are people who run shows, or, I mean, even in our case with podcasts, you know, Jules and I both endeavor to be actually quite as honest and as much ourselves in this podcast. But, you know, for people that the people have a social media face, which won't necessarily reflect the reality of who they are. So we have lots of secret identities, actually. And we also kind of like the satisfaction of feeling like we know something that others don't, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, we like kind of being secretive and we like play acting, you know, imagining what if, you know, I was this amazing person. What if that was me? And we love doing that. And we do it all the time as kids where we imagine that we're heroes. And I don't know whether that has been informed by the fiction that we've been consuming, where you have the whole secret identity thing, or whether it's actually coming from something much more fundamental in our desire to be heroes. And the fact that we can almost convince ourselves, of course I'm a hero. It's just that nobody knows it, but deep down I am actually a hero.
Yeah.
And I think it's the two things. I think that they play into one another. And that we have secret lives. So I think that's why people enjoy it so much, as well as the fact that it adds another level of tension and lots of layers of complication whenever you've got one person trying to be two people.
Yeah, definitely. It was something that this is going to be seem like a weird connection, but that Thomas Hardy once said that basically that the most interesting character you can create is completely two-dimensional, and I am paraphrasing here, he didn't actually say two-dimensional, but it's completely simple and straightforward, if you like, compared to the average person walking down the street.
Yeah.
And that's something as an author that you can't recreate entirely, because and in reverse, you know, we obviously say that we don't necessarily deliberately write full people that we know in life into our books. But you can slice off a piece of someone's personality, and some people are, you know, are fertile fields for this, and you can slice them into about seven different characters, and no one will ever know because it's not the whole person. So, I mean, you take somebody, take a trait and exaggerate it, and then build the character around that. And that's where a lot of it comes from. Sometimes we don't even know we were doing it.
Yeah.
It's when you find that you've written yourself into a book and you didn't realise you were doing that until like three books.
Yeah. I think we've run out of time, Jules.
We have come to a natural close, I think.
Well, before we go then, let's just put it out to our listeners out there. Who's your favourite double life leading hero? Are you a DC fan? Are you Marvel? Or do you like to look into sort of spy literature instead? Please do let us know. Send us a message. Leave us a comment. And before we depart, Jules, I believe that you have our Dissecting Dragons recommendation for the week.
I do. And this week, it is another arc, I'm afraid. So it's not out till the 2nd of October, but add it to your reading list because it's awesome. And it's a young adult contemporary novel, which is unusual for me.
Okay.
And it's called What If It's Us by Becky Albertalli and someone else whose name I can't remember, sorry. it's an amazing LGBTQ love story. And it's basically Sleepless in Seattle, but queer and set in New York. And it's about this summer romance between two guys who meet unexpectedly in a post office and how they proceed from there and how this connection and the fact that they pursue it sort of changes how they approach the rest of their lives for the better. And it is funny and sweet and poignant and a tiny bit frustrating, but in the best possible way.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, I'll be adding that to my to-be-read list.
Yes.
And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.